I'd like to invite up our honored volunteer for this month, Leslie O'Hagan. And before she lights the chalice, I want to tell you a bit about Leslie. Leslie has been a Unitarian for 20 years and a member of First Unitarian Church of Victoria since 2005. She and her family discovered Unitarianism in Plano, Texas. Teaching is her profession, and in 2006, she took the training for the OWL Sexuality Education course and regularly teaches the program here. Fiesta Night is her specialty as a community dinner organizer, so you can thank her for Fiesta Night. Lisa Greenlee says, Leslie is a caring, kind, and supportive person, always willing to lend a hand and seek the opportunity to make the lives of others better. And Faye says, the children's program has hugely benefited from her zeal for safeguarding the well-being of children, which has prompted her to be a devoted OWL education volunteer for more than 10 years. Leslie, please light our chalice. And speaking of Faye, I'd like to welcome her forward to share the story for all ages. If there's any children out there in the chairs, you're welcome to come forward. There's a nice cozy quilt, and you're very welcome to bring your adults with you.
No more children? So, Paul is talking about spirituality today, and I thought I'd just got me thinking about Reverend Melora's definition of it. It's about connecting with something bigger than yourself. Might be the community. Might be music. Might be love, a feeling of love.
Yeah.
Might be, well, eating bananas, says Luke. But where I usually feel that deep connection is in nature, in that interdependent web of all being. And I think it runs a little bit in my family. Here on Mother's Day, of course, I'm thinking of stories my mother told. And one of them was of herself as a little girl loving it when her mom would come upstairs and whisper her awake at 5:30 in the morning. Seems crazy, doesn't it? I don't think my kids would like it, but my mom liked it. She was the seventh of 10 children. So this was a chance for her to have some time alone with her mom. And they would go out in the garden. And mom talked about the beautiful morning light in the garden and the feel of the feathery carrot tops on her legs and the dewdrops, seeing the dewdrops on leaves of nasturtiums, which she loved to pick up and eat. It was a special time. Do you have a story you wanted to say?
No.
She was a seventh of 10 children in her family. Yes, yes. So it was a time where she really connected both with nature in their garden and with her mom. My dad surprised me last week. He was over for lunch, and he's, you know, more of an atheist than my mom was. And I said, did you ever have an experience that felt a little bit magical? And he answered like that. He said, oh yeah, I remember a Christmas concert where the whole family was traveling the 3 miles, 5 kilometers to the school that he went to. Normally he rode his horse to school, but when the whole family went, his dad needed to hitch up the wagon. And it being winter, he took the wheels off the wagon and put on sled runners. And his mom filled the wagon box with hay and quilts. So he and his brothers snuggled into the wagon box, staying warm on that cold, cold night, and went into the Christmas concert. He said, on the way home, it was amazing. It was so quiet, because it was just the sled runners on the snow, the hard-packed snow, so it was just a shh sound. And he was looking up at the moon, so, so bright, and the stars twinkling. He said it made him happy that he grew up poor and grew up in the countryside. And then when they got home, he went into the house, but there was something, and he doesn't know what it was. It compelled him to go back outside. And next thing you know, his dad found him fast asleep in the wagon. My first memory of really connecting with nature is also outside. My friend Susan came for a sleepover. Hi, Natty. And we decided to blow up the air mattresses and get the sleeping bags, and we went out into the garden. And, of course, we were lying side by side all night, yakking away. We were probably talking about boys. We were about 12. And then we noticed a shooting star flash across the sky, and then another one, and another. And that stopped us. And we decided that we should link pinkies the next time there was a shooting star. And that just got us completely quiet. And we lay there looking at the beautiful night sky, and we succeeded. We managed. The rule was you had to link pinkies without talking. So we did it. I don't remember what I wished, but what I do wish for all of you is to have that feeling of connection somewhere today, somewhere this week. Maybe it'll be in nature. Maybe it'll be with your families. Maybe it'll be here.
On this Mother's Day, I'd like to invite forward our Minister Emerita, Reverend Jane Bramadat, for our meditation. You may also know Jane as the mother of three, including our speaker, Paul Bramadat, and her daughters, Karen and Kimberly Bramadat Ramsey, who are both with us here today.
You might be interested, and some of you will know this, of course, that one of the women given credit for creating Mother's Day was a Unitarian, Juliet Ward Howe, a poet, a philosopher, and a social activist who lived in the 19th and 20th centuries, that is from 1819 until 1910. She saw Mother's Day as a protest against war and hoped starting this Mother's Day time would push people towards peace. It's still being worked upon, as we all know. But what I discovered recently is that Mother's Day is slowly going through a transformation and now produces many mixed feelings. The highly commercialized nature of Mother's Day is seldom a good thing. Sometimes mothers were cruel to their children and did not deserve praise. Some immigrants perceive Mother's Day with fear, as it might possibly separate mothers from their children. These are just a few of the examples of changes that have been observed. But for some words to take us into a time of thoughtful meditation with regards to Mother's Day, I invite you to listen to these words of Canadian author and poet Lorna Crozier. They are part of a poem called In Praise of Women. It is not only the women we know, our friends and sisters, our mothers climbing the stairs after work, weariness heavy on their backs. It is also the women of Greenham Common, their chain of endurance and belief stretching the heart. The women of El Salvador, of Nicaragua, keening for sons and husbands. The lost villages, the empty places where nothing grows. The women who walk with stones in their hands, with numbers on their wrists, with pieces of their bodies missing. Though they have been broken, they hold babies across oceans and the endless reach of prairie. Our sisters, our mothers, our daughters join hands. These women make us holy. May we appreciate here what we have and work harder to make our world balanced and caring for all. May it ever be so.
Good morning, everybody. Nice to be back. I look forward to this. I come here about every year to give a sermon, and it feels like some not awful medical intervention. So thank you. If you're a man over 50, you kind of know what I'm alluding to. So I'd like to take this opportunity to wish all the mothers here a very happy Mother's Day. I'd like to especially wish my mother a happy Mother's Day. She was the very best mother I could have had. though in fairness, I only ever had one. And it wasn't as though I had a lot of options. But thank you very much. I love you very much, and I look forward to spending a good part of the rest of the day with you. I'd like to also wish my wife a happy Mother's Day. She's the mother of my son, Max, and a tremendously gifted mother, and she overlooks my many shortcomings, and that is one of her greatest gifts. Thank you. As some of you will know, in 2005, the British Columbia government registered a new logo and trademark for the province. While many people had become accustomed to the older branding of supernatural British Columbia and the simple, beautiful British Columbia that had appeared on license plates for years, then Premier Gordon Campbell thought the province needed a branding boost in the run-up to the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver. The new slogan was not the product of the thorough branding processes with which many Canadians are well acquainted. Such processes often produced the blandest brands, as we saw decades ago when, after $2.1 million worth of consultation, the Manitoba government launched their new Spirited Energy brand. One can only imagine that their final decision was determined by a computer that paired the top-rated results. The computer's second choice was presumably Cinnamon Home, or perhaps Sunrise Mother Bicycle. Meanwhile, in British Columbia, though, we grew dissatisfied with being just supernatural and beautiful, and so in 2007, we became officially the best place on Earth. Not just an excellent place, not just awesome, but like the best place on Earth. Sorry, Denmark. Sorry, Thailand. Sorry, south of France. Now, look, there were sighs and sneers, not just from people in what we call the rest of Canada, but also from among my more modest British Columbian neighbors. However, not everyone thought that this new branding exercise was tacky. Between 2007 and 2011, about 200,000 British Columbians paid an extra fee to trumpet their province's bestness on their vehicles. Hands up those of you who did that. Really? Seriously? Liars. There's got to be like five of you in here who are not telling the truth. And when we visited during that period, Karen and I thought, this must be some kind of clever, ironic, hipster joke. But no, it was an actual government policy. Now, all joking aside, although the slogan was a classic example of narcissistic overreach, it did tell a truth, which is that many people in this province do believe that BC, and I would say the so-called Cascadia bioregion, stands apart from every other place on Earth. Now, in today's sermon, which is as much lecture as sermon, when I say Cascadia bioregion, I'm talking about the area between Oregon, Washington, British Columbia. It's really a watershed. About 85% of the population of the Cascadia bioregion lives around Seattle, Portland, Vancouver, and Victoria. There is, of course, a real difference between kind of the urban and rural context of Cascadia. Cascadia is also the place where the Oregon militia thrives. Okay, so it's not all Fernwood, granola, and vaccine-hesitant people. Don't even get me started on that. So that's the place we're talking about. Now, this perspective of the bestness of this area is not exactly new. In the 1949 novel, The Innocent Traveler, Ethel Wilson's protagonist says, "It's so lovely that I feel I've wasted my life in not living here before." In 1937, the great humorist Stephen Leacock quipped, "If I had known what it was like, I wouldn't have been content with a mere visit. I would have been born here." Now, you may be wondering what this all has to do with religion and spirituality. Well, I want to argue that the Cascadia bioregion, where we live, in the Cascadia bioregion, religion and spirituality take different forms than they take elsewhere. Now, as it happens, at the research center I direct at the University of Victoria, we just received a large grant from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada to study exactly this question of religion and spirituality in Cascadia. Once the data begins to roll in, I'll have other things to say about it. But for now, I want to spend this sermon with sharing some reflections based on the core intellectual and religious questions that really animate the project. Now, although the striking natural environment of Cascadia spans two countries, a unique social and political culture has emerged in this bioregion with its own history, ethos, and norms. There is actually a Cascadian independence movement called Cascadia Now, which some of you may have heard about, that has branches in both Cascadia North and Cascadia South. In the spring of 2016, I attended one of their big events in Seattle on Cascadia Day, and I met a fascinating mix of hippies, hipsters, computer programmers, hikers, hackers, intellectuals, libertarians, Democrats, frustrated Republicans, they didn't know what was coming, artists, and students. When asked why Cascadia Day fell on May 18th, the event organizers explained that that was the day that Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980. And that event stands as a kind of a reminder of the fragility of human life in this area and also of the grandeur of its sort of geology. Most people associated with the Cascadia Now movement appear to be interested in increasing what they call bioregional identification or bioregional consciousness, although there were a few secessionists and survivalists among them. One of the distinctive features of this region is a particular approach to the institutions, ideas, and practices associated with religion and spirituality. I'll get to that in a moment, but I need to say that historically, not only was the region the site of extraordinary natural beauty that animated what I call a reverential naturalism among many residents, but also a unique environment for religious communities was created here through the challenges of settlement, economic development, political contestation, and the physical and psychological distance between this region and everywhere else in North America. That was actually quite key, the way in which the mountains kind of represented a kind of a fence. Now, although religious monopolies and oligarchies have existed in a number of places in North America, you think about Quebec and also in parts of Ontario, Cascadia may be, as the historian Lynn Marks said, born secular, in the sense that the large Christian churches of the 19th centuries, like the Lutherans, the Anglicans, Presbyterians, Catholics, never really achieved a kind of a lock or a control on this region, as they did elsewhere in many parts of North America. This helps to explain the relative prominence of Cascadia's what we call religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S, when compared to other regions in Canada and the United States. Now, I have to say that this region was categorically not tabula rasa. It was not a blank slate when settlers arrived, obviously. Indigenous communities have lived here for millennia and have well-established political, legal, aesthetic, moral, cultural, and spiritual traditions that have survived centuries of mistreatment and misrecognition from dominant settler societies on both sides of the border. That's a very sad and very complex story that I'd be very pleased to tell on another occasion. Indeed, I've recently launched with a colleague of mine, John Burrows, and Heidi Stark as well at UVic, a project which actually focuses on the ways in which Indigenous spiritualities show up in the Canadian public arena, in the legal context as well as the political context. But that's for the near future. The local and global forces I have mentioned combined to produce four main forms of religion and spirituality in Cascadia, and I kind of want to give you a bit of a sense of them. Collectively, I think these types of religiosity produce what you might think of as a mood that I call really the Cascadia consensus. First, we see a relatively large and growing cohort of people who say they have no religion. Again, we call these the nuns. They're a relatively or quite important part of this place. For example, according to the 2011 National Household Survey, which was, you may remember, the survey that replaced the census when Stephen Harper received, I don't know, four complaints from Alberta and decided that we didn't really need a national census anymore, so let's have a voluntary survey. Anyway, that's another thing. And we dealt with that, thankfully. So according to the 2011 National Household Survey, 44% of British communes do not identify with any religious tradition, compared with 21% in the rest of Canada and 23% in Ontario, which is really kind of our most logical comparator province. The proportion of nuns increases to 53% among the province's millennials, those born between 1982 and 1996. In this city, in Victoria, the no religion rate surpassed 51% in 2011, and that's among the entire adult population. making it arguably the most irreligious city in the country and in the continent, and probably, I'm going to guess, in human history in the Western Hemisphere. I'm not kidding. My students, meanwhile, are just going to go, well, whatever. You know, they have no sense of how weird this is, and I have to tell them, like, you have no idea that you are living, you know, in at the beginning of a very weird time in the arc of human history. It's part of a job of a professor to remind them of this kind of thing. So those were 2011 numbers, and things have just gotten have kept on moving in that direction. I think probably by today, the number of British Columbians would be about 50% who are nuns, and the number of Victorians would be probably in the 57% range. Okay, among my millennial students, it's got to be in the 70s. Okay. Those are actually many people, many of those millennials actually don't even have parents who were religious, right? So that is a real new thing. In Winnipeg, when I started my career as a professor, many of the students, many of whom were nuns, remembered being raised as Jews or Christians or Buddhists, and then they stepped away. And we're talking now about students whose parents don't even remember that, right? So it's a very different thing. And this is, I mean, I'm a sociologist of religion sort of by disposition, and so I don't really have a horse in the game, you know, in the race, rather. So this is a curious thing for me. It's a very troubling thing for other people. Even south of the border in the relatively more religious United States, 30% of residents in the Pacific region identified as religious nuns in the 2012 U.S. General Social Survey, compared with 19% in the rest of the country. And again, those numbers have also gone up in both cases. There are, of course, questions one needs to ask about exactly what a nun is. Is it a kind of a temporary phase? We're not talking about atheists, okay? That's different. That's a different category. But these are just people who say they have no religion. But regardless of the misgiving some of us might have about these statistics, as the saying goes, they do not tell us nothing. The fact that twice as many British Columbians say they have no religion than anybody else in the rest of the country is an important indicator of the distinctiveness of this place. Now, the second and main form of religiosity and spirituality one finds here consists of the small and actually shrinking number of liberal or mainline Christian communities in this region. Although Christianity was never formally established in Cascadia, until the middle of the 20th century, its leaders nonetheless could have pretty good confidence that they were able to speak to and be heard by the dominant culture. These groups are now trying to reinvent themselves, and you can feel the panic among these communities. In some cases, it's having really positive impacts, or it's a very creative act. I think of a friend, Logan McManamy, who's the bishop of the Anglican community here, and he's really been very brave and very forthright about his efforts to reimagine what it might mean to be a Christian in this place, and especially to be in different kind of relations with the Indigenous communities. So there are real signs of creativity at work here. But many Christians, though, are acutely aware that if they don't find a new way to speak to this dominant society, they will become what I might call religious boutique religions. Okay, they will be of lasting interest to a very small number of people, a kind of harmless practice that isn't really expected to make a difference in the broader world, but might offer real personal pleasure and satisfaction to individuals. In many mainline Christian churches in Victoria, you'll see shrinking Sunday schools and pews where the average age is, you know, 68, 75, somewhere in that range. So it's a quiet Victoria-style crisis, but it's a crisis nonetheless. Now, the third species of religion that characterizes this place is the one about which the least has been written. While the relatively high number of nuns and the declining strength and numbers of the major Christian denominations in Cascadia do get some media and academic attention, an equally interesting feature of this region is the growth of relatively conservative communities of Christian and non-Christian backgrounds. Now, on the one hand, both new and traditional forms of Protestantism, ranging from evangelicalism to fundamentalism, have had success at responding to Christians interested in religious experience but no longer comfortable in the existing denominational homes. Several of these groups are actually oriented toward millennial Cascadians, which has been a really clever marketing technique. If you go to Glad Tidings Pentecostal Church downtown Victoria on a Sunday night, you'll see between 700 and 800 people between ages 15 and 30. And that, by the way, is one of just three services they have that day. And that's just one of these kinds of churches. On the other hand, non-Christian groups, especially Muslims, Buddhists, Sikhs, and Hindus, have grown rapidly here, largely due to immigration. In fact, almost entirely due to immigration. They have a slightly higher birth rate, but it's principally about immigration. When compared with the dominant ethos of Cascadia, many non-Christian and non-liberal Christian religious communities embrace more traditional views with respect to gender roles and sexual ethics, recreational drug use, generational hierarchies, scripture, and individualism. This is likely to cause some rifts in our culture in the future, but my guess is that this will all be quite manageable, as it's been manageable for a long time. In most of these communities, steady flows of immigration have meant that the growth rates are between 50 to 85% every decade. Okay, every decade. So if when you compare what's happening in these groups to what's happening in, say, the United Church or Presbyterians or Lutherans, it's really a dramatic difference. Finally, the fourth trajectory in the region is a form of religiosity in which we see an openness to experimentation, usually without any significant concern about the social, personal, familial, or occupational costs of such efforts. When I ask my students, almost all of whom are still privileged white kids, how their parents would feel if they learned that they'd fallen in love with a person from a religious background that is not like their own, the students kind of shrug. You know, there would be negotiation and awkwardness and adaptation, but nobody fears excommunication or shunning. This, I have to tell them, is totally new. They go like, meh, whatever. You know, but some of you folks in here who are, let's just say, over 70, will remember, especially if you're from Ontario and parts of the prairies, that a mixed marriage was, you know, a Lutheran and a Catholic, right? And you might actually have to leave your town if you did that, right? So just the world is changing so rapidly, and my students are quite blasé about it, and I think that's actually quite good. This is actually quite new historically. Of course, many people are critical as well when we're talking about this kind of this sort of new way of thinking about religion. Many people are critical of the ways people on the West Coast adapt aspects of Asian cultures and religions, especially, for example, yoga, mindfulness, meditation, and so forth. On another occasion, I'd be happy to talk about the interest in yoga in the West. In fact, as it turns out, Unitarianism plays a very significant historical role in the arrival of yoga in North America, but that's for another day. So, yeah, I'm setting up the next 5 years of my... Yeah, it'll be like a mini-series. Yeah, because if I lose my job at the university, I always want to have something else to come to. And that's actually, surprise, a real possibility. No. No, I mean, yoga is kind of one of my pet passions, and so, not even a pet passion, it's a central passion. And when I was learning about yoga and discovering actually that Unitarianism was actually quite central in the early years of the development of yoga, both as a philosophical and as a physical practice in India, it's quite an interesting story to tell. Now let me talk about migration and settlement, because that actually is an important piece of this story. Historians of religion and irreligion have often noted that Cascadia has a history of being, as it were, on the edge in every sense. Now, most Canadians fly over the mountains, and so much of the region passes by quickly and serenely below their gaze. But even those of us who drive through the mountains can hardly imagine what it must have been like a century or more ago as settlers traversed the prairies and then the mountains. Part of the story of migration, of course, was the experience of moving to the far reaches of the, or their, known world. It tended, therefore, to attract a very specific sort of person. Moving so far away from one's families and the centers of power meant that migration here involved, and still involves, actually, an untethering of oneself and one's family from tradition, or a rethinking of tradition in new and experimental ways. So migration is hard wherever you're from, whether you're coming from Asia and settling in Newfoundland or you know, wherever you happen to settle. But there's something about the migration process to this place that has created a society in which twice as many people are irreligious or are religious nuns than anywhere else in the country. Now I'm going to go off the grid a little bit here and suggest that the distinctiveness of religion in this place has something to do with the sorts of people who settled in BC, the people who are already here, and something about the essence of the particular realities of nature in this part of the world. Now, Perhaps this seems self-evident, but to illustrate my point, I want to contrast the two regions I know best, which is Cascadia and the prairies. In the second context, on the prairies, pioneer life and even life today is not just hard, but deadly. For 30 winters that I spent in Winnipeg, I never could forget the raw, heartless power of nature. I would walk half an hour to work every day, regardless of the weather, so that can range easily from minus 25 to minus 40 in the winter. And that was before wind chill. I could never silence the voice that would remind me that I could very easily die or lose digits if I twisted my ankle and nobody noticed, because I was going to work early in the morning, and this was before iPhones, right? So I could never really silence that little kind of reptilian voice in the back of your head saying, this is not such a good idea. And I'll never forget the day in February when I was standing inside the foyer of the University of Winnipeg, kind of opening my eyes because my eyelashes had frozen shut. Those of you from prairies will know what I'm talking about. And a friend of mine, an indigenous colleague of mine, walked past me and he said, "This is why we were nomadic, Paul." That was Marie Sinclair's son, actually, who said that. And that always stuck with me. You know, of course, they had it all sorted out. Like, move. You know, seriously, it's minus 50. Get out of there. Look, so I'm a child and an adult of the prairies, and I love that landscape. But that is a place of horizontal and elusive beauty. It requires your attention and your patience. And then, even when your eyes and your heart are open enough to appreciate the kind of beauty so well captured by people like Sharon Butala, Tim Lilburn, the Weakerthans, and Don Gayton, you will need to brace yourself for the long and heartless winter and for the clouds of mosquitoes, even in the city, either of which would lead Victorians, Torontonians, and Montrealers to call in the army. It was not an accident that in his book, The Pursuit of Happiness, From Plato to Prozac, U of T's Mark Kingwell referred to Winnipeg, also his hometown, as Plague City. So in Cascadia, though, the beauty doesn't really require your attention. It's just there, and it reaches in and grabs your attention. And yet, there's a kind of a tame quality to the beauty here. Sure, you can die from a cougar attack or exposure to the elements, but you have to be making some pretty big mistakes if you do that. In most of this region, the elements don't feel like they're out to get you. Okay, and on the prairies, they are out to get you. They don't care about you, and they are like, they're looking for you. Okay? The elements here, instead, feel like they're out to impress you. I'll always remember, I'm not sure if they've changed things, or maybe just the trees have grown in, but I remember giving a sermon here, maybe 15 years ago, before we moved here, and looking out in the middle of my sermon and seeing, you know, swans swimming across the little pond over there, and just stopping and remarking that. And still, I'm the one at the University of Victoria who stops in the middle of talks if a deer walks past. And, you know, the actual born Victoria just kind of, oh, deer. It's as though this region and this island were designed by some clever real estate agent. I mean, it totally worked for us. My point is that the combination of a temperate climate, a low level of pestilence, and the abundance of food, in addition to the almost shocking beauty of the mountains, the oceans, the valleys, and so forth, makes this region unusual, or at least different than any of the urban and rural contexts out of which most settlers come. Now, although I realize I've begun to sound a bit like a shill for tourism BC, I would like to suggest that these speculations are not idiosyncratic musings. There are studies, actually, that link a certain kind of secularization to a certain kind of physical beauty. There are two sociologists in the United States who did this very interesting study. What they did is they looked at each American county, okay, and they assigned each county what they called a natural amenities score. And you can think of that as kind of a score where you'd have a very high score if you had lots of natural beauty, so mountains, lakes, a very accessible set of nature trails and so forth, and good weather. And they gave each of the counties a score, okay? And so they mapped that. And you won't be surprised to know that most of the highest scoring counties were mostly on the West Coast, and a couple in Florida, and a couple in the kind of New England area. Now, then what they did is they said, okay, now let's correlate these scores with what we know about religion in the United States. Let's see if there's any correlation. Maybe there isn't, maybe there is. This is what a sociologist does. And they found that whenever you have a very high natural amenity score, in other words, a high level of beauty or prettiness or a capacity to engage the natural world, you had a low level of religiosity. And it was predictable pretty much in every county where you had high levels of beauty. So it turns out the lovelier your natural environment, the lower the likelihood that religion will be a strong feature of your community. But here's the deal. Okay, don't get the wrong idea. This is not to suggest that residents have other, better, prettier things to do on a Sunday than be involved in religious institutions. The other possibility, and I think this is really kind of their richer point, the other possibility is that in a place and time in which conventional religious institutions are less and less salient, less and less, they have less and less leverage, the natural world itself is clearly experienced as an alternative site for being religious and spiritual. That's actually the real point of their study. So let me put this in academic terms, as if it hasn't been academic enough. The dominant story about Cascadian religion and spirituality is animated by a certain liberation narrative, according to which the individual achieves its fullness and its fulfillment through a natural world that is both distinctly awe-inspiring and quite tame, and that leads to the four forms of religiosity that I mentioned earlier. Now, there is, of course, a shadow side to this story, which is that this liberation story tends to have been dependent, historically, on the dispossession of indigenous communities, the destruction of a great deal of our wild spaces, and the exploitation of women and Asian immigrants. If I might quote the opening line of the great American novel, 13 Moons, by Charles Frazier, there is no scatheless rapture. Although the Cascadia consensus, this reverential naturalism that characterizes this place, has its own often dark history, this is Mother's Day, so I want to keep things positive, because I'm a positive kind of guy. So, in conclusion, my interest in religion and spirituality in this region grows out of my own sense of the value of thinking about religion outside of the bounds of conventional institutions. But what might we learn by looking for signs of religiosity and spirituality, not just outside the bounds of institutional religion, but simply outside? In Cascadia, it's often nature that leaves the most indelible mark on the religious and spiritual culture of this region. And so that is one of the places we should look for innovations. And we should also look, of course, within institutions, but we should also look without. In this rich bioregion, we see many of the same forces that are unfolding throughout Western liberal democracies. Other regions in North America and the rest of the world might not be blessed by Cascadia's natural amenities, but there are political and social forces at work in the rest of Canada that might nonetheless propel those regions in a westward direction. In this sense, Cascadia is an excellent laboratory for seeing some of the deeper forces at work in the way we think about and experience religion, nature, and spirituality. This laboratory, or this shrine, is as much out there with the swans as it is in here, though both places are sites of community, solidarity, and wonder. Thank you.
In Earth's common things, truth stands revealed. Grass and flowers and stars spell out its name.